Great Plays. The National Broadcasting Company presents Great Plays, a series of famous plays selected to show the development of drama from the sunrise performances in ancient Athens down to the contemporary theater. We're privileged to have with us Mr. Burns Mantle, outstanding American drama critic and known throughout the country for his yearly volume of Broadway's Best Plays. He will act as commentator at today's production of She Stoops to Conquer, in which Margalo Gilmore is featured as Kate Hardcastle. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mantle.
Yes, sir, here we are again, my play-going friends. After a holiday rest, we are starting you home from a grand tour. We have visited with the dramatists of Greece and Italy, of France and Elizabethan England. Now we are back in England. But we have moved out of the 17th and are about to leave the 18th century. As we take up the second series of great plays, we begin our approach to a theater that lies close to the foundation of our own. The play is Oliver Goldsmith's farce, She Stoops to Conquer, which proved the outstanding comedy success of its season in 1772 and 73. It was Goldsmith's second play. His adventures in the theater had not been happy. In fact, any playwright, young or old, who is completely discouraged by his chance of success, should read the Goldsmith story. He was 40 years old before he tried writing for the theater. He had suffered practically all the slings of outrageous fortune. His features had been disfigured by smallpox. He had been a dull student in school. He had run away from college as the result of having staged a wild party in his rooms. He had, following the wishes of his reverend father, taken up the ministry only to be set down by the bishop of his diocese. He had even tried to come to America, but missed the ship. After he had studied medicine and applied for a hospital berth, he had to borrow a suit of clothes in which to take his examinations. He was a resourceful fellow, however. When he failed the examinations, he pawned the clothes. Even with such a start, Goldsmith lived to write what one of his biographers has declared to be the finest poem, the most charming novel, and with one exception, the best comedy of the period. The poem was The Deserted Village, the novel The Vicar of Wakefield, and the comedy She Stoops to Conquer. She Stoops to Conquer was, as I say, Goldsmith's second play. The first, The Good-Natured Man, he wrote in 1768, when he was, as usual, deeply in debt. It was produced at Covent Garden and created an uproar. In those days, drama critics were not confined to a few timid gentlemen sitting in aisle seats. Every member of the audience was a critic. They sat all over the house and did everything but tear up their seats when they were displeased. Now all they tear up is their programs, or perhaps a reputation or two. But when She Stoops to Conquer was produced, the Goldsmith triumph was complete. This time his critics threatened to tear down the house with enthusiasm. And it may interest you to know that a production of this comedy was a part of the inaugural celebration in New York following the election of George Washington. It has several times been revived with distinguished casts. It is a sort of godfather to all the mistaken identity plays that have been written since then. Now, if you are ready, we will get along to Covent Garden, which has long shared with Drury Lane the honor of housing England's greatest theater traditions. The date is March 15, 1773. The lobbies of the great theater are filled with the beauty and fashion of the day. And now the curtain is rising. The scene is a room of Squire Hardcastle's somewhat ancient but lovely home. The squire is expecting a visit from the son of his old friend, Sir Charles Marlowe. He hopes young Marlowe will like his daughter, Kate. Mrs. Hardcastle is scheming to marry her stupid son, Tony, to a Hardcastle niece, Constance Neville. Just now, the Hardcastles are in the midst of a domestic scene that, even after 166 years... has a familiar ring.
I vow, Mr. Hardcastle, you're very particular. Is there a creature in the whole country but ourselves that does not take a trip to town now and then to rub off the rust a little?
Aye, and bring back vanity and affectation that last them the whole year. In my time, the follies of the town crept slowly among us, but now they travel faster than a stagecoach.
Aye, your times were fine times indeed. You've been telling us of them for many a long year. Here we live in this old rumbling mansion that looks for all the world like an inn, but that we never see company. Our best visitors are old Mrs. Oddfish, the curate's wife, and little Cripplegate, the lame dancing master. And all our entertainment, your old stories of Prince Eugene and the Duke of Marlborough. Oh, I hate such old-fashioned trumpery.
And I love everything that's old. Old friends, old manners, old books, old wine. And I believe, Dorothy, you'll own that I've been pretty fond of an old wife.
Oh, Lord, you're forever at your old Dorothy's and your old wives. You may be a Darby, but I'll be no Joan, I promise you. I'm not so old as you'd make me. add 20 to 20.
Let me see. 20 added to 20 makes just 50 and 7.
Oh, it's false, Mr. Hardcastle. I was but 20 when I had Tony by Mr. Lumpkin, my first husband. And he's not come to years of discretion yet.
No, nor ever will. I dare answer for him. You've taught him finely.
No matter. Tony Lumpkin has a good fortune. My son is not to live by his learning. I don't think a boy wants much learning to spend $1,500 a year.
Learning, quotha? A mere composition of tricks and mischief.
Oh, humour, my dear. Nothing but humour. Come, Mr. Hardcastle, you must allow the boy a little humour.
I'd sooner allow him a horse pond. Why, it was but yesterday that he fastened my wig to the back of my chair. And when I went to make a bow, I popped my bald head into Mrs. Fizzle's face.
And am I to blame? The poor boy was always too sickly. A school would have been his death. When he comes to be a little stronger, who knows what a year or two's Latin may do for him.
Latin for him? Cat and a fiddle. No, no. The ale, the house and the stable are the only schools he'll ever go to.
Well, I believe we shan't have him long among us. Anybody who looks in his face can see he's consumptive.
Aye, if growing too fat be one of the symptoms.
He coughs sometimes.
Yes, when his liquor goes the wrong way.
Oh, I'm absolutely afraid of his lungs.
Truly, so am I. For he sometimes hoops like a speaking trumpet.
Yoo-ho! Yikes! Yikes! Oh-ho! Yikes!
Uh-huh. Oh. Here he comes. Ooh. A very consumptive figure, truly.
Tony, where are you going, my charmer?
I'm in haste, Mother. I can't stay. The three pigeons expects me down every moment.
The alehouse, the old place, I thought so.
Oh, pray, my dear, disappoint your friends for one night at least.
As for disappointing them, I should not so much mind, but I can't abide to disappoint myself.
Oh, you shan't go.
I will, I tell
I
you.
I say you shan't.
We'll see which is the strongest, you or I.
There goes a pair that only spoil each other. But is not the whole age in a combination to drive sense out of doors?
Father?
There's my pretty darling Kate. The fashions of the times have almost infected her, too. By living a year or two in town, she's as fond of gauze and French frippery as the best of them. Blessings on my pretty innocence. Dressed out as usual, my Kate, eh? Goodness! What a quantity of superfluous silk hast thou got about thee, girl.
You know our agreement, sir. You allow me the morning to receive and pay visits and to dress in my own manner. And in the evening I put on my housewife's dress to please you.
Well, remember, I insist on the terms of our agreement. And by the by, I believe I shall have occasion to try your obedience this very evening.
I protest, sir, I don't comprehend your meaning.
To be plain with you, Kate, I expect the young gentleman I've chosen to be your husband from town this very day.
Oh!
I have his father's letter, in which he informs me that his son is set out, and that he intends to follow himself shortly after.
Indeed, I wish I'd known something of this before.
Well, depend on it, child, I'll never control your choice. But Mr. Marlowe is the son of my old friend Sir Charles Marlowe, of whom you've heard me talk so often. The young gentleman has been bred a scholar. I'm told he's a man of an excellent understanding.
Is he?
Very generous.
I believe I shall like him.
Young and brave.
I'm sure I shall like him.
And very handsome.
My dear Papa, say no more. He's mine. I'll have him.
And to crown all, Kate, he's one of the most bashful and reserved young fellows in all the world.
Eh? You've frozen me to death again. That word reserved has undone all the rest of his accomplishments. However, if he be so young, so handsome, and so everything as you mention, I believe I'll have him.
All right, Kate. But there's still an obstacle. It's more than an even wager that he may not have you.
My dear Papa, why will you mortify one so? Well, if he refuses, instead of breaking my heart, I'll look out for some less difficult admirer.
Bravely resolved. Meantime, I'll go prepare the servants for his reception. As we seldom see company, they want as much training as a company of recruits the first day's muster.
Lad, this news of Papa's puts me all in a flutter. Young, handsome, these he puts last. I would put them foremost. Sensible, good-natured, I like that. But then reserved and sheepish, that's much against him. Yet, can't he be cured of his timidity? I wonder.
Tony has made good his threat as having a gay time at the Three Pigeons when we walk in on him. It is here Tony meets young Harlow and Hastings, his friend. They are in search of the Hardcastle house, and Tony, being a cut-up, deliberately misdirects them.
Let's go, masters, puzzle their brain with grammar and nonsense and learning. Good liquor I stoutly maintain, just genius are better discerning. Let them brag of their heathenish gods, their leafies, They're Styxes and Stygians.
Stygians.
They're Quees, they're Quiz, and they're Quads. They're all but a parcel of pigeons. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah.
Ah, come, my boys, drink and be merry, for you pay no reckoning. Well, Stingo, what's the matter?
There'll be two gentlemen in a postchaise at the door. They've lost their way in the forest, and they're talking about Mr. Hardcastle.
As sure as can be, one of them must be the gentleman that's coming down to court my sister. Do they seem to be Londoners, landlord?
I believe they may. They look like Frenchmen.
Then desire them to step this way, and I'll set them right in a twinkling.
Yes, Master Tony.
Oh, gentlemen, as they mayn't be good enough company to you, be off for a moment, and I'll be with you in the squeezing of a lemon.
Come on,
step this way, gentlemen, if you please.
Oh, what a tedious, uncomfortable day have we had of it.
And all, Marlowe, from that unaccountable reserve of yours. They would not let us inquire more frequently on the way.
I own Hastings. I am unwilling to lay myself under an obligation to everyone I meet and stand the chance of an unmannerly answer.
Not likely to receive any answer here.
No offense, gentlemen, but I am told you have been inquiring for one Mr. Hardcastle in these parts.
Well?
Do you know what part of the country you are in?
Not in the least, sir, but shall thank you for information.
Nor the way you came?
No, sir. But if you can inform us...
Why, gentlemen, if you know neither the road you are going...
No.
Nor where you are, nor the road you came, the first thing I have to inform you is...
Yes?
That you have lost your way.
No. We wanted no ghost to tell us that.
Oh, pray, gentlemen, is not this Hardcastle a cross-grained, old-fashioned, whimsical fellow with an ugly face, a daughter, and a pretty son?
We have not seen the gentleman, but he has the family you mentioned.
The daughter, a tall, traipsing, trolloping, talkative maypole. The son, a pretty, well-bred, agreeable youth that everyone is fond of.
Our information differs in this. The daughter is said to be well-bred and beautiful. The son, an awkward booby, reared up and spoiled his mother's apron strings.
Then, gentlemen, all I have to tell you is that you won't reach Mr. Hardcastle's house this night, I believe.
Unfortunate.
It's a long, dark, boggy, dirty, dangerous way. Stingo!
Yes, sir?
Tell the gentleman the way to Mr. Hardcastle.
Mr.
Hardcastle's of Quagmire Marsh. You understand me?
Oh, Master Hardcastle. Lackadaisy, my masters, you've come wrong.
What?
You should have crossed down Squash Lane.
Crossed down Squash Lane?
Then you were to keep straight forward till you came to where four roads meet.
Come to where four roads meet?
Aye, but you must be sure to take only one of them.
Oh, sir, you're facetious.
So then, keeping to the right, you are to go sideways until you come upon Farmer Murren's barn. Coming to the barn, you turn to the right, and then to the left, and then to the right above again, till you find out the old mill.
Zounds, ma'am, we could as soon find out the longitude.
What's to be done, Marlowe?
This house promises but a poor reception, though perhaps the landlord can accommodate us.
Elect, master, we have but one spare bed in the whole house.
And to my knowledge, that's taken up by three lodgers already. Then let me see. What if you go on a mile further to the Buck's Head? The old Buck's Head on the hill. One of the best inns in the whole country.
Master Tony, you being sending them to your father's as an inn, be you?
You fool. Let them find that out. You only have to keep on straight forward till you come to a large old house by the roadside.
Oh.
You see a pair of large horns over the door. Mm-hmm. Now that's the sign. Drive up the yard and call stoutly about you.
Sir, we are obliged to you.
Mm.
The servants can't miss the way.
No. But I tell you, though, the landlord is rich and going to leave off business. So he wants to be thought a gentleman saving your presence.
A troublesome old blade to... A troublesome old blade, to be sure. But he keeps as good wines and beds as any in the whole county.
Well, if he supplies us with these, we shall want nothing further. We'll return to the right, did you say?
No. Straight forward. I'll just step myself and show you a piece of the way. That's for you, Stingo.
Bless your heart for a sweet, pleasant... damn mischievous son of a... Well, no matter.
Young Marlowe and Hastings have found the Hardcastle house, which they accept as an inn, and are being ushered into the parlor by Diggory, an old family servant who is accustomed to receiving unexpected guests. These particular guests make themselves quite at home.
Welcome, gentlemen. Very welcome. This way.
After the disappointment of the day, welcome once more, Charles, to the comforts of a clean room and a good fire.
Aye.
Upon a word, a very well-looking house. Antique, but creditable.
The usual fate of a large mansion. Having first ruined the master by good housekeeping, it at last comes to levy contributions at an inn.
And I suppose we passengers are to be taxed to pay all for these fineries.
Travellers, George, must pay in all places. The only difference is that in good inns you pay dearly for luxuries. In bad inns, you're fleeced and starved.
You have lived pretty much among them. In truth, I've been often surprised that you have seen so much of the world could never quite... acquire assurance with women.
But tell me, George, where could I have learned that assurance you talk of? My life has been chiefly spent away from that lovely part of the creation. I don't know that I was ever familiarly acquainted with a single modest woman, except my mother. But among females of another class, you know...
among them, you are impudent enough of all conscience.
They are of us, you know.
But in the company of women of reputation, I never saw such an idiot, such a trembler. You look for all the world as if you wanted an opportunity of stealing out of the room.
Why, man, that's because I do want to steal out of the room.
This rate, man, how can you ever expect to marry?
Never unless, as among kings and princes, my bride were to be courted by proxy.
I pity you. But how do you intend behaving to the lady you are come down to visit at the request of your father?
As I behave to all other ladies, bow very low, answer yes or no to all her demands. But for the rest, I don't think I shall venture to look in her face.
I'm surprised that one who is so warm a friend can be so cool a lover.
Happy men. You have talents and art to captivate any woman, Hastings. I'm doomed to adore the sex and yet to converse with the only part of it I despise. This stammer in my address and this awkward, unprepossessing visage of mine.
Gentlemen.
Sure, this fellow here to interrupt us.
Gentlemen, you are heartily welcome. Which is Mr. Marlowe? Yes. Sir, you are heartily welcome.
He's got our names from the servants already. We approve your hospitality, sir. I've been thinking, George, of changing our travelling clothes.
Oh, I beg, Mr. Marlowe, you'll use no ceremony in this house. This is Liberty Hall, gentlemen. You may do just as you please here.
Well, my good friend, if you gave us a glass of punch in the meantime, it would help us to carry on.
Punch, sir? This is the most unaccountable kind of modesty I ever met with.
Yes, sir, punch. A glass of warm punch after our journey will be comfortable. This is Liberty Hall, you know.
Diggory, bring in the punch.
Yes, sir, yes, sir. Yes, sir, here it is, sir.
Ah, here are the cups, sir. Now, I hope you'll find it to your mind. I've prepared it with my own hands. Will you be so good as to pledge me, sir? Here, Mr. Marlowe, here is to our better acquaintance.
From the excellence of your cup, my old friend, I suppose you have a good deal of business in this part of the country. Warm work now and then at elections, I suppose.
Oh, I do stir about a good deal, that's certain, but half the differences of the parish are adjusted in this very parlour.
And you have an argument in your cup, old gentleman, better than any in Westminster Hall.
Aye, young gentleman. That and a little philosophy.
Well, this is the first time I ever heard of an innkeeper's philosophy.
Here's your health, my philosopher.
Ah, good, very good. Thank you, thank you. Your generalship puts me in mind of Prince Eugene when he fought the Turks at the Battle of Belgrade. You shall hear.
Instead of the Battle of Belgrade, I believe it's almost time to talk about supper. What has your philosophy got in the house for supper?
For supper, sir? Was ever such a request to a man in his own house? Oh, really, sir, as for supper, I can't well tell. My Dorothy and the cookmaid settle those things between them. I leave those kind of things entirely to them.
Oh, you do, do you?
Oh, entirely. By the by, I believe they're in actual consultation upon what's for supper this moment in the kitchen.
Then I bet they'll admit me as one of their privy council. No offence, I hope,
sir. Oh, no, sir, no, none in the least. Yet I don't know how our Bridget the cookmaid is not very communicative upon these occasions. Should we send for her, she might scold us all out of the house.
Let's see your list of the larder, then. I ask it as a favour.
Sir, he's very right.
Sir, you have a right to command here. Here, Diggory.
Yes, sir?
Bring us the bill of fare for tonight's supper. I believe it's drawn out.
Yes, sir, yes.
Your manner, Mr. Hastings, puts me in mind of my uncle, Colonel Wallop. It was a saying of his that no man was sure of his supper till he'd eaten it.
His uncle, a colonel. We shall soon hear of his mother being a justice of the peace. Let's hear the bill of fare.
For the first course, a pig's head and prune sauce.
Oh, damn your pig, I say.
And damn your prune sauce, say I.
Oh, yes, gentlemen. To men that are hungry, pig with prune sauce is very good eating.
Here's calves, tongue and brains.
Let your brains be knocked out, my good sir. Don't like them.
Their impudence confounds me. gentlemen, you are my guests. Make what alterations you please.
Item, a pork pie. A boiled rabbit and sausages, a pudding, and a dish of tiff-taff-taffety cream.
Confound your made dishes. I shall be as much of the loss in this house as at the French ambassador's table. I'm for plain eating.
Well, I'm sorry, gentlemen, that I've nothing you like, but if there be anything you've a particular fancy to...
Why, really, sir, your bill of fare is exquisite. Any part of it is as good as another. Send us what you please. So much for supper. And now to see that our beds are aired and properly taken care of.
Oh, I entreat you, leave all that to me.
Oh, leave that to you. I protest, sir, I always look to these things myself.
Oh, I must insist, sir, you make yourself easy on that head.
You see, I am resolved on it. Very troublesome fellow, this Hastings.
Well, sir, I am resolved at least to attend you. This may be modern modesty, but I never saw anything look so like old-fashioned impudence. This way, sir. This way.
I, too, find this fellow's civilities troublesome. But who can be angry at attentions meant to please him?
Oh, Miss Neville. By all that's happy.
My dear Hastings, to what unexpected good fortune, to what accident am I to ascribe this happy meeting?
Rather let me ask the same question, as I could never have hoped to meet my dearest Constance at an inn.
An inn? Oh, sure you mistake. My aunt, my guardian, lives here. What could induce you to think this house an inn?
My friend, Mr. Marlowe, with whom I came down, and I have been sent here as to an inn, I assure you. A young fellow whom we accidentally met at a house hard by directed us hither.
Certainly, it must be one of my hopeful cousin Tony's tricks, of whom you've heard me talk so often.
He whom your aunt intends for you?
Oh, you have nothing to fear from him, I assure you. You'd adore him if you knew how heartily he despises me. My aunt knows it, too, and has undertaken to court me for him, and actually begins to think she has succeeded.
Oh, you must know, my Constance, I have just seized this happy opportunity of my friend's visit here to get admittance into the family. If my dearest girl will trust in her faithful Hastings, we shall soon be landed in France.
I have often told you that though ready to obey you, I yet should leave my little fortune behind with reluctance. The greatest part of it consists of jewels. The instant they are put into my possession, you shall find me ready to make them and myself yours.
Oh, perish the baubles. You are all I desire. In the meantime, a friend Marlowe must not be let into his mistake.
But how shall we keep him in the deception? Miss Hardcastle has just returned from walking. What if we still continue to deceive him?
Oh, good. Oh, here he comes.
The assiduities of these good people tease me beyond bearing. My host seems to think it ill manners to leave me alone, and so he claps not only himself, but his old-fashioned wife on my back. They talk of coming to sup with us, too. What have we got here, Hastings?
My dear Charles, let me congratulate you. The most fortunate accident. Who do you think is just delighted?
I cannot guess.
Our mistress's boy, Miss Hardcastle and Miss Neville. Give me leave to introduce Miss Constance Neville to your acquaintance.
Sir?
Miss Neville, happening to dine in the neighborhood, they called on their return to take fresh horses here. Wasn't it the most fortunate thing in the world?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very fortunate. A most joyful encounter, but our dresses, George, you know, are in disorder. What if we should postpone the happiness till tomorrow? Tomorrow at her own house.
By no means. Your ceremony will displease her. Besides, she knows you're in the house.
Oh, the devil. How shall I support it? Hey, Hastings, you mustn't go. You're to assist me, you know.
I hear her coming.
Sure, man. It's but the first plunge and all's over. She's but a woman, you know.
And of all women, she I dread most to encounter.
Miss Hardcastle. Mr. Marlowe. I am proud of bringing two persons of such merit together that only to know to esteem each other.
I'm glad of your safe arrival, sir. I'm told you had some accidents, by the way.
Only a few, madam. Yes, we had some. Yes, madam, a good many accidents, but... I should be sorry to, madam, or rather glad of any accidents that are so agreeably concluded.
Never spoke better in your whole life. Keep it up, and I'll ensure you the victory.
I'm afraid you flatter, sir. You, that have seen so much of the finest company, can find little entertainment in an obscure corner of the country.
I have lived here, indeed, in the world, madam. I've kept very little company. I've been but an observer upon life, madam. Well, others were enjoying it.
Bravo, bravo. Never spoke so well in your whole life. Well, Miss Hardcastle, I see that you and Mr. Marlowe are going to be very good company. I believe our being here will but embarrass the interview.
No, not in the least, Mr. Hastings. We like your company. Sounds, George, sure you won't go. How can you leave us?
Our presence will but spoil things, so we'll retire to the next room. You don't consider, man, that we want a little tete-a-tete of our own.
But you have not been wholly observer. I presume, sir, the ladies, I should hope, have employed some part of your addresses.
Pardon me, madam. I should have studied only to deserve them.
And that, some say, is the very worst way to obtain them.
Perhaps so, madam. But I love to converse with the more grave and sensible part of the sex. I'm afraid I grow tiresome.
Not at all, sir. There's nothing I like so much as grave conversation myself. I could hear it forever.
I can't help observing that...
You were going to observe, sir?
Yes, I was observing, madam, I protest, madam, I forgot what I was going to observe.
I vow, and so do I.
But I am sure I tire you, madam.
Not in the least, sir. There's something so agreeable and spirited in your manner, such life and force. Pray, sir, go on.
Yes, madam. I was saying that there are some occasions when a total want of courage, madam, destroys all the... And puts upon a...
I agree with you entirely. A want of courage upon some occasion assumes the appearance of ignorance and betrays us when we most want to excel. I beg you, proceed.
Yes, madam. Morally speaking, madam, I see Miss Neville expecting us in the next room. I wouldn't intrude for the world.
I protest that I was never more agreeably entertained in all my life. Pray go on.
Yes, madam. But she beckons us to join her, madam. Shall I do myself the honor to attend you?
Well, then I'll follow.
Certainly, madam, certainly.
Was there ever such a sober, sentimental interview? I'm certain he scarce looked at my face the whole time. Yet the fellow, but for his unaccountable bashfulness, is pretty well, too. He has good sense. If I could teach him a little confidence, it would be doing somebody that I know of a piece of service. But who is that somebody? That, faith, is a question I can scarce answer.
Next morning, Squire Hardcastle and his daughter Kate are trying to match their experiences with the surprising Marlowe. To the squire, he is an impudent fellow, but to Kate, no more than awkwardly modest.
I wonder, Kate, what could my old friend Sir Charles mean by recommending his son as the modestest young man in town? To me, he appears the most impudent piece of brass that ever spoke with a tongue. He's taken possession of the easy chair by the fireside already. He tore off his boots in the parlor and desired me to see them taken care of.
You taught me to expect something extraordinary, and I find the original exceeds the description.
I was never so surprised in my life. He's quite confounded all my faculties.
I never saw anything like it. And a man of the world, too.
Aye, he learned it all abroad. What a fool was I to think that a young man could learn modesty by traveling.
It seems natural to him.
Good deal assisted by bad company and a French dancing master.
Sure, you mistake, Papa. A French dancing master could never have taught him that timid look, that bashful manner.
Whose look? Whose manner, child?
Mr. Marlowe's. His timidity struck me at the very first sight.
Oh, and your first sight deceived you, for I think him one of the most brazen first sights that ever astonished my senses.
Sure, sir, I never saw anyone so modest.
Can you be serious? I never saw such a bouncing, swaggering puppy since I was born.
Surprising. He met me with a stammering voice and a look fixed on the ground.
He met me with a loud voice and a familiarity that made my blood freeze.
He treated me with diffidence and respect.
He spoke to me as if he knew me all his life before, interrupting my best remarks with some silly pun. And when I was in my best story of the Duke of Marlborough and Prince Eugene, he asked me if I had not a good hand at making punch. Yes, Kate, ask your father if he was a maker of punch.
One of us must certainly be mistaken.
Well, if he be what he's shown himself, I'm determined he shall never have my consent.
And if he be the sullen thing I take him, he shall never have mine.
In one thing, then, we are agreed, to reject him.
Yes, upon conditions. If you find him more respectful, and I more importunate, I don't know. The fellow's well enough for a man.
If we should find him so, but that's impossible. The first appearance has done my business.
And yet there may be many good qualities under that first appearance.
When a girl finds a fellow outside her taste, she then sets about guessing the rest of his furniture. With her, a smooth face stands for good sense, and a genteel figure for every virtue.
I hope, sir, a conversation begun with a compliment to my good sense won't end with a sneer at my understanding.
Oh, pardon me, Kate.
And as one of us must be mistaken, what if we go to make further discoveries?
Aye, agreed. But depend on it, I'm in the right.
And depend on it, I'm not much in the wrong. Here's my maid. I must speak to her father.
Huh, brazen puppy. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
So that was the way of it, ma'am.
What an unaccountable creature is that brother of mine, to send him to the house as an inn. I don't wonder at his impudence. Poor father. Thank you, Poppy, for telling me.
And what is more, madam, the young gentleman, as you passed by in your present dress, asked me if you were the barmaid. He mistook you for the barmaid, madam.
Did he? Then, as I live, I'm resolved to keep up the delusion. Tell me, Poppy, how do you like my present dress?
It's the dress, madam, that every lady wears in the country, but when she visits or receives company.
And you're sure he does not remember my face or person?
Certain of it.
Vow, I thought so. Although we spoke for some time together, yet his fears were such that he never once looked up during the interview. Indeed, if he had, my bonnet would have kept him from seeing me.
But what do you hope from keeping him in his mistake?
In the first place, I shall be seen. And that is no small advantage to a girl who brings her face to market. Uh-huh. Then I shall perhaps make an acquaintance. And that's no small victory gained over one who never addresses any but the wildest of a sex. But my chief aim is to take my gentleman off his guard and examine the giant's force before I offer combat.
But are you sure you can act your part and disguise your voice so that he may mistake that, as he has already mistaken your person?
Never fear me. I think I've got the true bar talk. Did your honor call? Attend the lion there. Pipes and tobacco for the angel. The lamb has been outrageous this half hour.
It will do, madam.
Oh,
but he's here. Go quickly. I'll stand back at the door.
What a bawling in every part of the house. I have scarce a moment's repose. If I go to the best room, there I find my host with his story. If I fly to the gallery there, we have my hostess with her curtsy down to the ground. I've at last got a moment to myself, and now for recollection.
Did you call, sir? Did your honor call?
As for Miss Hardcastle, she's too grave and sentimental for me.
Did you call?
No, no, child. Besides, from the glimpse I had of her, I think she squints.
I'm sure, sir, I heard the bell ringing.
No, no, no. I've pleased my father, however, by coming down, and I'll tomorrow please myself by returning.
Perhaps the other gentleman called, sir.
I tell you, no.
I should be glad to know for sure, sir.
No, 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 I tell you, let me look at you. Yes, child, I think I did call. I vow, child, you're vastly handsome.
Oh, la, sir, you make one ashamed.
Never saw a more sprightly, malicious eye. Yes, my dear, I did call. Have you got any of your in the house?
No, sir, we've been out of that these 10 days.
One may call in this house, I find, to very little purpose. I suppose I should call for a taste, just by way of trial, of the nectar of your lips. Perhaps I might be disappointed in that, too.
Nectar? Nectar? That's a liquor there's no call for in these parts. French, I suppose. We keep no French wines here, sir.
Of true English growth, I assure you.
Then it's odd I should not know it. We brew all sorts of wines in this house, and I've lived here these 18 years.
18 years? Why, one would think, child, you kept the bar before you were born. How old are you?
Oh, sir, I must not tell my age. They say women and music should never be dated.
Well, to guess at this distance, you can't be much above 40.
Oh?
Yet nearer, I don't think so much. By coming close to some women, they look younger still. But when we come very close indeed...
Oh, please, keep your distance. One would think you wanted to know one's age as they do horses by mark of mouth.
I protest, child, you use me extremely ill. If you keep me at this distance, how is it possible you and I can ever be acquainted?
And who wants to be acquainted with you? I want no such acquaintance, not I. I'm sure you did not treat Miss Hardcastle that was here a while ago in this obstropolous manner. I'll warrant me, before her, you kept bowing to the ground and talked for all the world as if you were before a justice of the peace.
Gadget's hit it, sure enough. A mere awkward squinting thing. No, no, I find you don't know me. I laughed and rallied her a little, but I was unwilling to be too severe. No, I couldn't be too severe, curse me.
Well, then, sir, you are a favorite among the ladies.
Yes, my dear, a great favorite. And yet, hang me, I don't see what they find in me to follow. At the ladies' club in town, I'm called their agreeable Rattle. Rattlechild is not my real name, but one I'm known by. My name is Solomons. Mr. Solomons, my dear, at your service.
Oh, sir, you're introducing me to your club, not to yourself. And you're so great a favorite there, you say.
Yes, my dear, there's Mrs. Mantrap, Lady Betty Blackleg, the Countess of Sligo, Mrs. Langhorns, old Miss Biddy Buckskin, and your humble servant keep up the spirit of the place.
Then it's a very merry place, I suppose.
Yes, as merry as cards, wine, supper, and old women can make us.
And their agreeable Rattle.
Gary, don't quite like this. She looks knowing, methinks. You laugh, child.
I can't but laugh to think what time they all have for minding their work or their family.
Do you ever work, child?
I sure. There's not a screen or a quilt in the whole house. But what can bear witness to that?
Oh, so? Then you must show me your embroidery. If you want a judge of your work, you must apply to me.
Aye, but the colours don't look well by candlelight. You'll see it all in the morning.
And why not now, my angel? Such beauty fires beyond the power of resistance. The old man here, my old luck, my old luck.
So, madam, so I find this is your modest lover. This your humble admirer that kept his eyes fixed on the ground and only adored at humble distance. Kate, Kate. Art thou not ashamed to deceive your father so?
Never trust me, dear papa, but he's still the modest man I first took him for. You'll be convinced of it as well as I.
By the hand of my body, I believe his impudence is infectious. Didn't I see him seize your hand? Didn't I see him haul you about like a milkmaid? And now you talk of his respect and his modesty.
But if I shortly convince you of his modesty, I hope you'll forgive him.
The girls would actually make one run mad. I tell you, I'll not be convinced. I am convinced. He has scarcely been 3 hours in the house, and he's already encroached on all my prerogatives.
Sir, I ask but this night to convince you.
You shall not have half the time. I've thought of turning him out this very hour.
Give me that hour, then.
and I hope to satisfy
well,
you.
Well, an hour, let it be then. Brazen puppy.
It is the evening of the same day, but much has happened. Tony, up to his usual mischief, and much preferring Bet Bouncer to Miss Neville, has stolen the jewels from his mother for Miss Neville, that she and Hastings may elope. Hastings has given the jewels to Marlowe, and he has returned them to their original holder by a servant.
What this could mean by sending me so valuable a thing as a casket to keep for him, and he knows the only place I have is the seat of a postcoach at an inn door. Have you deposited the casket with the landlady as I ordered you? Have you put it into her own hands?
Yes, Your Honor.
She said she'd keep it safe, did she?
Yes, she said she'd keep it safe enough. She asked me how I came by it. She said she had a great mind to make me give an account of myself.
The safe, however.
Yes, sir.
What an unaccountable set of beings have we got amongst. This little barmaid, though, runs in my head most strangely and drives out the absurdities of all the rest of the family. She's mine. She must be mine, or I'm greatly mistaken.
Bless me, Marlowe, you here. Oh, and in spirits, too.
Give me joy, George. Crown me, shadow with me with laurels. Well, George, after all, we modest fellows don't want for success among the women.
Some women, you mean. But what success has Your Honor's modesty been crowned with now?
Didn't you see the tempting, brisk, lovely little thing that runs about the house with a bunch of keys at its girdle?
Well, and what then?
She's mine, you rogue. Such fire, such motion, such eyes, such lips. But again, she wouldn't let me kiss them, though.
But are you sure, so very sure of her?
Why, man, she talked of showing me her work up upstairs, and I'm to improve the pattern.
But how can you, Charles, go about to rob a woman of her honor?
Oh, sure, sure, we all know the honor of the barmaid of an inn. I don't intend to rob her, take my word for it. There's nothing in this house I shan't honestly pay for.
I believe the girl has virtue.
And if she has, I should be the last man in the world that would trespass upon it.
Oh. You've taken care, I hope, of the casket I sent you to lock up. It's in safety?
Yes, yes, it's safe enough. I've sent it to the landlady to keep for you.
The landlady?
The landlady.
You did?
Wasn't I right? I believe you'll allow that I acted prudently upon this occasion.
You must not see my uneasiness.
You seem a little disconcerted, though, methinks. Sure, nothing has happened.
Oh, no, nothing. There was in better space in all my life. And so you left it with the landlady, who no doubt very readily undertook the charge.
Rather too readily, for she not only kept the casket, but through her great precaution, she was going to keep the messenger too.
They're safe, however.
As a guinea in a miser's purse.
And all hopes of fortune are at an end. We must set off without it. Well, Charles, I'll leave you to your meditations on the pretty barmaid, and may you be as successful for yourself as you've been for me.
Oh, thank you, George. I ask no more.
I no longer know my own house. It's turned all topsy-turvy. His servants have gone drunk already. I'll bear it no longer. And yet, for my respect for his father, I'll be calm. Mr. Marlowe, your servant. I'm your very humble servant.
Sir, your humble servant. What's the matter now?
I believe, sir, you must be sensible, sir, that no man alive ought to be more welcome than your father's son. I hope you think so.
I do from my soul, sir. I don't want much entreaty. I generally make my father's son welcome wherever he goes.
Yes, I believe you do from your soul, sir. But though I say nothing to your own conduct, that of your servants is insufferable. Their manner of drinking is setting a very bad example in this house, I assure you.
I protest, my very good sir, that is no fault of mine. If they don't drink as they ought, they are to blame. I ordered them not to spare the cellar. I did, I assure you. My positive directions were that as I did not drink myself, they should make up for my deficiencies below.
Oh, then they had your orders for what they do. I'm satisfied.
They had, I assure you.
And they're drunk. Drunk, sir, drunk.
Well, I don't know what you'd have more unless you'd have the poor devil soused in a beer barrel.
Rounds, he'll drive me distracted if I contain myself any longer. Mr. Marlowe, sir, I've submitted to your insolence for some hours, and I see no likelihood of it coming to an end. I'm now resolved to be master here. Yes, sir, and I desire that you and your drunken pack may leave my house directly.
Leave your house? Sure, you jest, my good friend. What, when I'm doing what I can to please you?
I tell you, sir, you don't please me. So I desire you to leave my house.
Sure, you cannot be serious at this time of night and such a night. You only mean to banter me.
I tell you, sir, I'm serious. And now that my passion's aroused, I say this house is mine, sir. This house is mine. And I demand you to leave it directly.
A puddle in a storm. I shan't stir a step, I assure you. This your house, fellow? It's my house. This is my house. Mine while I choose to stay. What right have you to bid me leave this house, sir? I never met with such impudence, never in my whole life.
Nor
before.
I, confound me if ever I did. To come to my house, call for what he likes, turn me out of my own chair, insult the family, order his servants to get drunk.
and then to tell me this house is mine, sir. By all that's impudent, it makes me laugh. Pray, sir, as you take the house, what think you of taking the rest of the furniture?
Bring me your bill, sir, bring me your bill, and let's make no more words about it.
There's the mahogany table that you may see your face in.
My bill, I say.
Oh, I'd forgot the great chair for your own particular slumber after a hearty meal.
Zounds, bring me my bill, I say, and let's hear no more on't.
Young man, from your father's letter to me, I was taught to expect a well-bred, modest man as a visitor here. But now, I find him no better than a coxcomb and a bully. Faith, he'll be down here presently, your father, and he shall hear more of it. He shall hear more of it.
How's this? Sure, I've not mistaken the house. Everything looks like an inn. The servants cry coming. The attendance is awkward. The barmaid, too, to attend us. She's here and will further inform me. Whither so fast, child? A word with you.
Let it be short, then. I'm in a hurry. Oh, I believe he begins to find out his mistake, but it's too soon quite to undeceive him.
Please, child, answer me one question. What are you, and what may your business in this house be?
A relation of the family, sir.
What, a poor relation?
Yes, sir, a poor relation, appointed to keep the keys and to see that the guests want nothing in my power to give them.
Oh, that is, you act as the barmaid of this inn.
Inn? Oh, Lord, what brought that into your head? One of the best families in the county keep an inn. Oh, Mr. Hardcastle's house, an inn?
Mr. Hardcastle's house? Is this house Mr. Hardcastle's house, child?
Aye, sure.
So, then all's out, and I've been damnably imposed on. Oh, confound my stupid head. I shall be laughed at over the whole town. To mistake this house of all others for an inn, and my father's old friend for an innkeeper. What a swaggering puppy must he take me for? What a silly puppy do I find myself? There, and I may be hanged, my dear, but I mistook you for the barmaid.
Oh, dear me, I'm sure there's nothing in my behavior to put me upon a level with one of that stamp.
Nothing, my dear, nothing. But I was in for a list of blunders, and I couldn't help making you a subscriber. But it's over. This house I no more show my face in.
Oh, I hope, sir, I've done nothing to disoblige you. I'm sure I should be sorry to affront any gentleman who's been so polite and said so many civil things to me.
By heaven, she weeps. This is the first mark of tenderness I ever had from a modest woman, and it touches me. Excuse me, my lovely girl. You're the only part of the family I leave with reluctance. But to be plain with you, the difference of our birth, fortune, and education make an honorable connection impossible. And I can never harbor a thought of taking advantage of one who trusted in my honor or bringing ruin upon one whose only fault was being too lovely.
Generous man, I begin to admire him. But I'm sure my family is as good as Miss Hardcastle's. And though I'm poor, that's no great misfortune to a contented mind. And until this moment, I never thought that it was bad to want fortune.
And why not, my pretty simplicity?
Because it puts me at a distance from one that if I had £1,000, I would give it all to.
Oh, the simplicity bewitches me so that if I stay, I'm undone. I must make one bold effort to leave her. Your partiality in my favor, my dear, touches me. And were I to live for myself alone, I could easily fix my choice. But I owe too much to the opinion of the world, too much to the authority of a father, so that I can scarcely speak it. It affects me. Farewell.
I never knew half his merits until now. He shall not go if I have the power or art to detain him. I'll still preserve the character in which I stoop to conquer, but will undeceive Papa, who perhaps may laugh him out of his resolution. Father! Father!
No. You may steal for yourself the next time.
No.
I've done my duty. She's got the jewels again. That's a sure thing. But she believes it was all a mistake of the servants.
But my dear cousin Tony, sure you won't forsake us in this distress. If she in the least suspects that I'm going off, I shall certainly be locked up or sent to my Aunt Pettigrew's, which is 10 times worse.
To be sure, aunts of all kinds are a damn bad thing. But what can I do? I've got you a pair of horses that will fly like whistle jacket. And I'm sure you can't say, but I've courted you nicely to deceive her. Here she comes. Now we must court a bit more for fear she should suspect us. Come on.
I never saw Tony so sprightly before. Ah, have I caught you, my pretty dove?
Oh.
Cousin Tony promises to give us more of his company at home. Indeed, he shan't leave us any more. It won't leave us, Cousin Tony, will it?
No, it's a pretty creature. No, I'll sooner leave my horse in a pond than leave you when you smile upon me so.
Agreeable cousin. Ah, he would charm the bird from the tree. I was never so happy before.
Mm.
The jewels, my dear Con, shall be yours incontinently.
Oh.
Isn't he a sweet boy, my dear? Mm. You shall be married tomorrow.
Oh. Where's the squire? I got a letter for you, Washington. Give it to my mama, Diggory. She reads all my letters first.
How's this? Dear squire,
I'm now waiting for Miss Neville with a postchaise and pair at the bottom of the garden. I expect you'll assist us with a pair of fresh horses as you promised. Dispatch is necessary, as the hag... the hag, your mother will otherwise suspect us. Yours, Hastings. Oh, grant me patience. I shall go distracted. My rage jolts me.
I hope, madam, you'll suspend your resentment for a few moments.
And you great ill-fashioned oaf. Oh, scarce enough sense in your mouth. Keep your mouth shut. Were you two joined against me? I'll defeat all your plots in a minute. As for you, madam, since you've got a pair of fresh horses ready, it would be too cruel to disappoint them. So if you please... Instead of running away with your spark, prepare this very moment to run off with me. Here, Thomas, Roger, Dilly, I'll show you. I wish you better than you do yourselves. I'll show you.
So, now I am completely ruined.
Aye, that's a sure thing.
What better could be expected from being connected with such a stupid fool?
So, sir, I find by my servant that you have shown my letter and betrayed us. Was this well done, young gentleman?
And here's another. Ask Miss there who betrayed you. Ikari was her doing, not mine.
Oh, I've been finely used here among you, rendered contemptible, driven into ill manners, despised, insulted, laughed at.
Here's another. We shall have old Bedlam broke loose presently.
And there, sir, is the gentleman to whom we all owe every obligation.
What can I say to him, a mere boy, an idiot, whose ignorance and age are a protection?
The poor, contemptible booby. That would but disgrace correction.
It was cunning and malice enough to make himself merry with all our embarrassment.
An insensible cub.
Replete with tricks and mischief.
Bah, damn it, but I'll fight you both.
What?
One after the other.
Come on, sir.
With baskets.
Oh, as for him, he's below resentment. But your conduct, Mr. Hastings, requires an explanation. You knew of my mistakes, yet would not undeceive me.
Tortured as I am with my own disappointments. Is this a time for explanations, Mr. Marlowe?
But, sir, you...
Mr. Marlowe, we never kept on your mistake till it was too late to undeceive you. Be pacified.
Hello, Constance. Why, Constance, I
say... I'm coming.
Oh. Just of the tangle, young Marlowe's father, Sir, old Sir Charles, arrives on the scene. And where one tangle is undone, another is created to take its place. It is Diggory and Hastings who are talking.
Yes, sir. Old Sir Charles has arrived, and he and the old gentleman of the house have been laughing at Mr. Marlowe's mistake this half hour. They are coming this way.
Oh, then I must stop this scene.
The peremptory tone in which he sent forth his sublime command.
And the reserve with which I suppose he treated all your advances.
Yeah, and yet he might have seen something in me above a common innkeeper, too.
Yes, Dick, but he mistook you for an uncommon innkeeper.
Well... I'm in too good spirits to think of anything but joy. Yes, my dear friend, this union of our families will make our personal friendships hereditary. And though my daughter's fortune is but...
Why, Dick, will you talk of fortune to me? My son is possessed of more than a competence already and can want nothing but a good and virtuous girl to share his happiness. If they like each other, as you say they do.
I saw him grasp her hand in the warmest manner myself. And here he comes to tell you himself.
I come, sir, once more to ask pardon for my strange conduct. I can scarce reflect on my insolence without confusion.
Oh, tut, boy, a trifle. You take it too gravely. An hour or two's laughing with my daughter will set all to rights again. She'll never like you the worse for it.
Sir, I shall always be proud of her approbation.
Approbation is but a cold word, Mr. Marlowe. If I'm not deceived, you've something more than approbation thereabout, you take me?
Really, sir, I have not that happiness.
Come, boy. I am an old fellow, and I know what's what as well as you that are younger. I know what has passed between you, but, ma'am...
Sure, sir, nothing has passed between us but the most profound respect on my side and the most distant reserve on hers.
But she's told no tales, I assure you.
I never gave her the slightest cause.
Well, I like modesty in its place well enough, but this is overacting, young gentleman.
May I die, sir, if I ever...
I tell you she don't dislike you, and as I'm sure you like her...
Yes, sir, I protest, sir...
I see no reason why you shouldn't be joined as fast as the parson can tie you.
But hear me, sir...
Your father approves the match, I admire it. Every moment's delay will be doing mischief, so...
But why won't you hear me? By all that's just and true, I never gave Miss Hardcastle the slightest mark of my attachment or even the most distant hint to suspect me of affection. We had but one interview, and that was formal, modest, and uninteresting.
This fellow's formal, modest impudence is beyond bearing.
And you never grasped her hand or made any protestations?
As heaven is my witness, Father, no. I hope you will exact no further proofs of my duty, nor prevent me from leaving a house in which I suffer so many mortifications... I'm going, Father.
Here comes my daughter, Kate. Come hither, child. Answer us. Has Mr. Marlowe made you any professions of love and affection?
The question's very abrupt, sir. But since you require unreserved sincerity, I think he has.
You see, Sir Charles?
And pray, madam, have you and my son had more than one interview?
Yes, sir.
Several.
You see?
But did he profess any attachment?
A lasting one.
Did he talk of love?
Much, sir.
Amazing. And all this formally?
Formally.
No, my friend. I hope you're satisfied.
And how did he behave, madam?
As all admirers do. Mentioned his heart, gave a short tragedy speech, and ended with pretended rapture.
No, I'm perfectly convinced indeed. I know his conversation among women to be modest and submissive. This forward, ranting manner by no means describes him.
Then what, sir, if I should convince to your face of my sincerity? If you and my papa in about half an hour will place yourself behind that screen, you shall hear him declare his passion to me in person. I see he comes.
Agreed. And if I find him what you describe, all my happiness in him must have an end.
And if you don't find him what I describe, I fear my happiness must have, never have a beginning. Quick, behind the screen.
Oh, my good girl, though prepared for setting out, I come once more to take leave. Nor did I till this moment know the pain I feel in the separation.
I believe these sufferings cannot be very great, sir. A day or two longer here, perhaps, might lessen your uneasiness.
It must not be, madam. I've already trifled too long with my heart.
Then go, sir. I'll urge nothing more to detain you. Though my family be as good as hers who came down to visit, and my education, I hope, not inferior, what are these advantages without equal affluence?
By heavens, madam, fortune was ever my smallest consideration. Your beauty at first caught my eye, for who could see that without emotion? Well, what at first glance seemed rustic plainness now appears refined simplicity. I am now determined to stay, madam. And I have too good an opinion of my father's discernment when he sees you to doubt his approbation.
No, Mr. Marlowe, I will not. Cannot detain you. Do you think I would suffer a connection in which there is the smallest room for repentance?
By all that's good, I can have no happiness but what's in your power to grant me. I will stay even contrary to your wishes.
Sir, I must entreat you. As our acquaintance began, so let it end in indifference. Seriously, Mr. Marlowe, do you think I would ever submit to a connection where I must appear mercenary and you imprudent?
No, madam, every moment that shows me your merit only serves to increase my diffidence and confusion. Here, let me continue. Let me kneel before you.
We can hold it no longer. Charles, Charles, how hast thou deceived me? Is this your indifference, your uninteresting conversation?
Your cold contempt, your formal interview. What have you to say now?
I'm all amazement. What can it mean, you two behind us listening?
It means that you can say and unsay things at pleasure. That you can address my daughter in private and deny it in public. That you have one story for us and another for my daughter.
Daughter? This lady, your daughter?
Yes, sir, my only daughter. My Kate. Who else should she be?
Oh, the devil.
Yes, sir, the very identical, tall, squinting lady you are pleased to take me for. Oh. She that you addressed as the mild, modest, sentimental man, and as the bold, forward, agreeable rattle of the ladies' club.
Zounds, there's no bearing this. It's worse than death.
In which of your characters, sir, will you give us leave to address you?
Oh, curse on my blundering head. I must be gone.
By the hand of me, buddy, but you shall not. I see it was all a mistake, and I'm rejoiced to find it. You shall not, sir, I tell you. I know she'll forgive you. Won't you forgive him, Kate?
I will.
Yeah, we'll all forgive you. Take courage, man.
I'll try.
Very right, my son.
So, boy, take her. And as you've been mistaken in the mistress, my wish is that you may never be mistaken in the wife.
Well, having stooped to conquer with success and gained a husband without aid from dress, still, as a barmaid I could wish it too, as I have conquered him to conquer you.
All's well that ends well, and a good joke is a good joke. That is the end of She Stoops to Conquer. Next week, we are to visit with another fine writer of English comedies, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, and hear his finest comedy, The School for Scandal. I trust you will be able to be with us then.
Today's performance was produced under the direction of William S. Rainey, who also adapted the play for the microphone. The commentator was Burns Mantle, prominent American dramatic critic. The music was arranged and the orchestra conducted by Joseph Haunty. Included in today's cast were Margot Gilmore, who played Kate Hardcastle, Alfred Shirley as young Marlowe, assisted by Harry Coopercliff, Lillian Tong, Mark Smith, Charles Webster, Eustace Wyatt, Kay Strutzy, William Podmore, Harry Neville, and Ivy Scott. The Great Plays series is an educational feature of the National Broadcasting Company. Next week at this same hour, School for Scandal by Sheridan will be presented. A study manual, part one, giving complete background material for the Great Plays by Blevins Davis, who arranged for the series, is available to our radio audience at the cost of 10 cents. Send coin or money orders to the National Broadcasting Company in care of Great Plays, Radio City, New York. Consult your local library for reading material on the remaining Great Play of the series. She Stooped to Conquer was a presentation of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.